Hello, Last Orders listeners. We've got a very special announcement for you before we get into this week's episode. We're going to be doing our very first live show. Yes, me, Chris, and some very special to-be-announced guests will be recording a live edition of this podcast at the Battle of Ideas Festival in Westminster on Saturday, the 28th of October. To those who don't know, the Battle of Ideas is a brilliant festival packed with dozens of fascinating debates and panels with world-renowned speakers, all organised by the Academy of Ideas. Me and Chris and Spikes in general are regulars there, and we really can't recommend it enough. So, to come along to our podcast and to enjoy an unrivaled programme of discussions on top of that, go to battleofideas.org.uk to get your ticket. You can get a day ticket for the Saturday or one for the whole weekend, and there are various offers and concessions available. Our pod will be at 2:45 p.m. in the council room in Church House, which is the beautiful Westminster venue for the festival. We can't wait to see you there. Once again, that's battleofideas.org.uk to get your tickets. Now, without further ado, let's get on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss the clash between liberalism and transgenderism, Ted Cruz's stand against booze guidelines, and Ursula von der Leyen's war on wolves. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tom. Hot out there, isn't it? Whew, what a scorcher.
Very hot indeed. Look forward to getting out there later on today. But before that, I'm delighted to join to the podcast for his first time, Mark Glendenning. Mark is a colleague of Chris's over at the IEA, where he's the head of cultural affairs. And most pertinently for today's discussion, he's the author of a new report called Transgender Ideology, A New Threat to Liberal Values. Hello, Mark.
Hello, hi.
So, Mark, let's start with you to talk about your report, because I think it makes a really interesting contribution to the whole debate that we're constantly having around gender ideology, transgenderism, in that you go beyond the kind of day-to-day battles and debates that we have about women's spaces, sex-based rights, and so on, through to what you see as the kind of more, the kind of broader philosophical picture, I guess. In your report, you make this case that transgender ideology is essentially a threat, an attack on liberal values of free society itself. To the extent that it's possible, could you put in a nutshell what you see that challenge, that threat as being?
Well, I think it's twofold. There's an immediate political problem, clearly, for, you know, people who are broadly politically liberal, in that the trans ideologists are seeking to suppress freedom of expression, any kind of intellectual challenge. You know, we have MPs like Nadia Whittam from the Labour Party, Alicia Kearns from the Conservatives, saying this shouldn't even be debated at all. And Theresa May is also supporting, you know, plans to make it illegal to have a private conversation with a person who's thinking of going down the road of medical surgery to try and gain the appearance of being a member of the opposite sex. And if you do anything other than affirming their inclination to go down this horrific path, this will become a criminal offence. I mean, this government is thinking of passing that into law, and Keir Starmer has recently confirmed that is what is going to happen if he becomes prime minister. So that's the immediate problem. I see a broader problem, which is essentially epistemological, in that trans ideology is attempting to create a firewall between our minds and objective reality. It's trying to delegitimize established ways of knowing and believing as a precursor to giving the political class and the people who go along with this ideology and allied belief systems like critical race theory, to give them the license to completely restructure society through theory. So it has a very postmodern quality to it. And that is a longer-term threat that if we lose this battle to maintain freedom of speech, the right to express rationally based beliefs, then in fact what we're going to see is a whole range of other types of viewpoint made illegal to express in this country.
And I think one point that you articulate in the report really well is something that we've been talking about at Spire for a while, which is the extent to which this is a movement that is obsessed with recognition. So it's often lumped in with things like the gay rights movement, for instance, which I think doesn't make any sense, because that was very much a kind of case of getting the state, getting the moral majority out of your lives, out of your bedroom. It was very much a kind of had an element of leave us alone, fuck you even. That was the kind of approach. What we've got with transgender ideology seems to be very different. There seems to be a demand being put on the states, but also on individuals, even in their own minds, to recognize their own subjective view of themselves, what it is they are, for that to be reflected in official documentation and everything. That's not only just a difference, but I think it seems, from what you've been saying, to be that's a core part of the problem here. Could you say a bit more about that? Why is that desire for recognition, validation, such a problem from the perspective of people who are interested in liberal values, objectivity, and so on?
Well, it involves, first of all, a return to a kind of primitivism, a tribal primitivism, whereby people's identities as part of some sort of group, some aspect of themselves, even if it is something that's completely imagined, as in this case with transgenderism, this then becomes made something that is sort of sacred, and that for somebody not to acknowledge it, somebody to take it on and challenge it overtly, becomes a violation of that person's self. So there's a profoundly mystical and primitivist quality to this, which is obviously very dangerous in a liberal society. But the other reason they are obsessed by enforcing public recognition of people's acquired gender stroke sex identity is that they believe, you know, going back to people, say, like Judith Butler, that unless you can force the whole society to accept this new reality, then in fact, people cannot actually transition into this new reality. So again, it's very postmodern. It's because they don't believe there's a fundamental objective truth. They believe that all conceptions of truth are politically manufactured. And so everything then becomes a zero-sum game between rival ideologies. And that's why they have no respect for free speech, or they don't believe in free speech, because they don't accept that you can have a kind of spontaneous cultural order in which we just agree to disagree and we go our own way. So trans people can assert whatever they want to about themselves. They can express their inner truth. But equally, you and I can say, with all due respect, I'm afraid I don't buy it. That is not acceptable to them. So there's a profoundly fascistic quality to all of this. It's very, very totalitarian. So even private speech has to be regulated, as we're seeing with this demand from both Labour and Conservative politicians, that private conversations should become something that could land you in jail.
And it just strikes me as being quite Orwellian. You know, a lot of things get described as Orwellian, but the corruption of language and truth is at the heart of 1984. The reason Jordan Peterson got into this in the first place, as I recall, was that not that he had any issue with trans people per se, just that the Canadian government was forcing people to refer to people in a certain way. And, if you identified as a woman, if you've been born a man, then the law, as I understand it in Canada, was saying, or the proposed law, I don't know if it went through, it was saying that it would be illegal to refer to that person as a man. And, Peterson's got a bit crazy since then, but I think he was actually bang on with that kind of stuff. It's worrying for all the reasons Mark's explained, and then he explains in his report that you've got people trying to create and force upon you this alternative reality and potentially use the force of law to try and do that. So, yeah, obviously that is pretty scary.
And Mark, on the point of where this is going, I guess, because there's always a temptation to look for tipping points, but one of the things that you say in the report is that recently there have been some interesting developments. There's been obviously the collapse of the gender self-ID bill in Scotland, sent large part taking down Nicola Sturgeon, in no small part, I should say. You've also had things like Baroness Faulkner at the Equality and Human Rights Commission, who is pretty firm on these issues, been advising the government to firm up the protections based around biological sex. There's been, of course, the gender critical feminists who have gone from being kind of incredibly demonized to being accepted figures in polite society and discussion, to a certain degree at least. Do you think that there's a kind of element that, because this ideology is so at odds with how most people see the world, also because it's so contradictory, it's one thing that you say in the report, it kind of believes that gender and identity is constructed by all these forces around you, yet at the same time it's an inner essence, doesn't really stack up. It feels like a worldview which is brittle, in the sense that it's very hard, but it can crack very easily as soon as it's subjected to public discussion. So are you hopeful for where things are headed, if that's not too glib a question?
I'm afraid I'm confused. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that there are encouraging signs of a fight back intellectually within the culture. But the trouble, as we saw in Scotland, is that the political and corporate and bureaucratic forces that have become completely possessed by this ideology, I mean, especially the, you know, police. We've seen this extraordinary incident in Hebden Bridge where a woman has been visited by the cops because she took a photograph of a feminist sticker that had been placed on top of a trans sticker, and they came round to warn her that she'd been seen on CCTV or reported by somebody, and that if she was to then pass this on, this would then, her photograph, this would be then a hate crime. So the trouble we have is that all the major institutions in our society have become possessed by this ideology. So the current government, I just read today, is thinking of allowing children to change their gender and have this recognized within schools. Now, this has huge implications for teachers. I mean, what are teachers going to be, going back to Chris's point about Jordan Peterson and mandated speech? Are teachers going to be sacked, disciplined, potentially even prosecuted once Labour come to power if they refuse to go along with this within the school environment? I mean, we've seen children either expelled or disciplined for refusing to go along with this. I mean, I don't know about you, but I used to be sent to the headmistress or the headmaster for, you know, being caught, I don't know, smoking or something in break time. I mean, it also opens, of course, the door up to, and I know this sounds all a bit, you know, Daily Mail and Richard Littlejohn, but it does, of course, open up the door to new forms of identity, and which could then in future become protected characteristics in law if you apply the Equality Act to them. So, you know, we've got now the furry movement. I mean, where does this end? If I suddenly redefine myself as a 12-year-old girl, is this, does this have to be, you know, recognized in law and by others?
Can I just mentioning teachers, just remind me there on a slightly later note, but same topic. Have you been keeping up with the Kayla Lemieux saga? Are you familiar with this person? Have you not seen this one?
I've missed the latest. I was away last week, so I missed the latest iteration. But this is the Canadian school teacher who wears these ridiculously oversized prosthetic breasts, seemingly, although he's never admitted this, as a kind of fetish, really. But would wear this to work. There was obviously a lot of concern from parents and so on. The school have stuck by him very firmly, as seemingly for wanting to be seen on the right side of trans rights and history and so on. But what was the latest, Chris? Are they just continuing to let him walk around with these things on, or what?
Well, the term time began. He's a primary school teacher. I mean, if you, listeners, if you're not familiar with this case, do Google Kayla Lemieux, because...
Not his real name, we should probably stress, but... or not his born name or whatever.
Kerry Lemieux. Actually, Lemieux is his real name. It's changed from Kerry to Kayla. To say the breasts are large is an understatement. I mean, they are... like something from this. I mean, they are unfeasibly large, completely unrealistic, like comedy norks. And there was a suspicion among some people, including myself, that this guy was just the world's greatest troll. And he was taking advantage of, you know, Canada going insane in the last few years to make the whole thing look stupid, you know. And I think that seems to have been borne out because the term time started, the police were getting ready for protests. I thought there was going to be trouble from parents and so on. And this dude just turned up, not wearing normal men's clothes, a bit overweight, quite a bit of stubble, like nothing had ever happened. And I don't think he's ever commented to anyone about it either. So this is part of the genius of this prank, if indeed it is a prank. But it looks like for whatever reason, it's all died down. And this guy has made his point and moved on. Or he could have just, you know, transitioned back. But personally, I think he's just an awesome troll.
I suppose he's a sort of Canadian version of Eddie Izzard without the enormous breasts, because Eddie Izzard, I think, claims part of the week to be a woman. And then part of the week he says he's a man. This gentleman in Canada, if he's not doing this as a sort of exaggerated Titania McGrath type, you know, joke stroke political point, it might be that he's more in the Izzardian, you know, category of trans activist.
You could believe that if it wasn't for the enormous breasts. I mean, that's, to me, the giveaway. Like I say, they have to be seen to be believed, but I don't...
I just spent a lot of time looking at these.
They're so funny that the whole thing has to be a joke. It has to be.
Well, I can only hope. I mean, it would be a genius prank if it was, just to explode the whole idea of self-identification. There's no better way of doing it. Chris, shall we move on to some of the nanny state stories that you picked out this week? The first one, you very helpfully in the email you sent over just provided a link to Ted Cruz saying that if Washington want him to only drink two beers, they can stick it up their arse or something. But there's more to this story. Is this official guidelines which Ted is objecting to? What's been going on in America?
Yeah. Well, it was Ted Cruz, who's kind of I don't really follow American politics as much as some of the nerds over here do. He strikes me as quite a risible kind of character, quite a sad character. Because didn't he get behind Trump? He got on the Trump train, didn't he, eventually in 2016, despite Trump saying that his dad killed Kennedy.
And that his wife was ugly. He just said that.
Yeah. Your wife's a dog. So he's kind of a pitiful character. And he was doing one of these rather sad, I guess, campaign ads in some factory with a bunch of blue-collar guys all holding a beer. And he was saying something along, well, we'll play the clip, but it's along the lines of, you can kiss my ass if you think I'm only going to drink two beers a week.
And now these idiots have come out and said, drink two beers a week. That's their guideline. Well, I got to tell you, if they want us to drink two beers a week, frankly, they can kiss my ass.
This tweet, like so many tweets these days, has got a community note under it saying that nobody is actually saying that Americans can be limited to two beers a week. But the kernel of truth in this is that the Canadians, we may have mentioned this before, I honestly can't remember, the Canadian government is on the brink of saying that should be the weekly guideline, the weekly recommendation, no more than two beers a week. And yeah, we saw our guidelines go down a few years ago for no good reason. They've been going down everywhere, really. It's the same group of people who are kind of feeding in the so-called science into this, say, oh, the science has suddenly changed dramatically. Because, I mean, previously it was like two or three drinks a day in Canada. And apparently the science has changed so dramatically in like 6 years, it's now going to be two a week. It's all going the direction of zero. I mean, that's the ultimate aim. You know, this is why you get so many people fervently denying that moderate drinking has health benefits, that there's no safe level of alcohol. Just they want to go down tobacco road, you know, usual thing, anti-tobacco playbook. I was just reading today that there's some class action lawsuit again in Canada. We should do a whole episode about Canada sometime. It seems like all the funniest, worst stuff comes out of there. There's some class action lawsuit being filed by, I think she's a woman in her 50s who has breast cancer, and she's saying that she started drinking, you know, when she was younger, and no one told her that alcohol causes breast cancer. And so they're suing Labatt's, you know, for this. Again, just straight out of the anti-smoking playbook. That's really all to say about that. Just, Ted Cruz got a little bit carried away there. But the Americans are looking at changing their drinking guidelines. They do it every few years. God knows why. The science never actually changes very much, to be honest. And if anything, these guidelines should be going up if they were following the science.
And I believe that we're also going to, well, we're on the subject of alcohol, we should check in Scotland with minimum pricing, which is a story that obviously you've been tracking for a very long time since they introduced it. And it does seem like no matter what the evidence is, they still proclaim it to be a success. But what is the latest evidence where this is concerned? And what are the Scottish, how have the Scottish government been spinning it, Chris?
Well, what we had last Monday were two bits of news on the same day about minimum pricing. Firstly, that the UK Statistics Authority had written to the Scottish government saying that this press release you put out in June saying that minimum pricing has been a wonderful success is not really a fair reflection of your official evaluation. So the official evaluation of minimum pricing conducted by Public Health Scotland, actually a very good piece of work, very thorough, 40 different studies in there, about 8 of them pertain specifically to health. And all but one of those studies found really essentially no evidence whatsoever for any benefit, no benefit in terms of A&E attendances or road traffic accidents, heavy drinking, underage drinking, all sorts of criteria, all of which are obviously supposed to get better when minimum pricing came in, and they couldn't find any evidence that they had improved. And indeed, they found some evidence of harm and unintended consequences. With the exception of one study, which we've discussed before, it's a modelling study, essentially. They took a counterfactual of what Scotland might have looked like, you know, what alcohol-related deaths in Scotland might have been in the absence of minimum pricing or what they actually were. And even though they went up massively and they're currently at a 14-year high, which was the second bit of news that came out last Monday, they said, oh, it's still lower than it would have been. And, of course, it's quite difficult to argue against something like that because it's entirely, you know, theoretical. It's exactly the same as you get with a sugar tax. You know, child obesity goes through the roof, then they say, well, it would have gone even further through the roof had it not been for the sugar tax. And so that's kind of where these people are stuck now, you know. And if you think about how long we spent arguing about this, there's the national debate about the sugar tax, Jamie Oliver, all this banging on and on, hysteria about the number of children who are obese. Sugar tax is absolutely essential. And then child obesity just keeps on going up afterwards, and they go, well, it would have been even worse. Minimum pricing was supposed to be virtually a silver bullet, you know, the way people went on about it. Alcohol-related deaths, you know, go again through the roof. And they say, well, it would have been, you know, look, to be absolutely fair to these people, the pandemic did have an effect on obesity and on heavy drinking, right? So it does make it more difficult to evaluate these things, not so much the sugar tax, because you had a couple of years of obesity rising before the pandemic hit, but particularly with minimum pricing. So yeah, it's harder to evaluate, but we have got this, you know, larger evaluation, like I say, 40 different studies, and the Scottish government just cherry-picked this one, all the public health people cherry-picked this one, and the UK Statistics Authority, good on them, wrapped them over the knuckles for it. And they actually had to change the press release. They deleted an entire paragraph in which he said disproves that you know, minimum pricing has been effective. So look, I guess we will never know for sure whether minimum pricing has had any positive effect. I would just say to public health campaigners, you know, for the next thing that you're campaigning about, whatever it may be, alcohol advertising bans and what have you, rather than go on about, you know, the number of people who are currently obese, a number of people who currently die from alcohol-related deaths, and acting as if this policy was going to do something, you know, reverse that trend, just say, well, you know, if you introduce this, things will still get worse, but maybe not as rapidly as they would have done otherwise. If they'd have said that back then, even the Scottish government wouldn't have introduced it, I don't think, right? These governments introduce these things, which have a big cost. Hundreds of millions of pounds minimum pricing has cost Scottish consumers. And they do them because they expect to see a notable downturn in the problem that is supposed to be addressed.
And Mark, unless you've got anything on the booze story, shall we move on to Wolves, which is a much more comical sort of setup? I don't know if you've been following this story as closely as we have, Mark, but this is becoming a core beat of this podcast.
Yes, what got me into the story was a sort of rather amusing tale, I mean, tragic, of course, at the same time, of the, you know, president of the European Commission who'd been in favor of, you know, releasing wild animals and, you know, increasing the wolf population until it, until one of them, you know, killed her beloved pet pony.
When the wolf was literally at her door.
Well, yeah, probably not at all, because she's got a big kind of estate. But,
stable dog.
At her paddock. But it seems to me there's something sort of very weird going on here, which I would be interested to know what the two of you, if you think there's some sort of connection or, you know, contradiction, that a lot of the people, you know, vaguely in the center of the political spectrum, center left, stretching right out to the kind of Extinction Rebellion crazies, are all, you know, mad for rewilding. I mean, George Monbiot, these people, they have some sort of Tory romantic love of, you know, the wild, and they all, you know, blame the Industrial Revolution for climate change and what have you. So they tend to be the sort of people who are saying, oh, we must release more dangerous animals into the environment. But then at one and the same time, they tend to be the kind of people like, you know, the European Commission, who want to regulate us, you know, in terms of what we can drink and eat, and now what we can say in private to trans people. And so they're fanatically obsessed by health and safety, you know, in one context. But then in another context, they kind of have this romantic vision of, you know, making the European environment more wild. I don't know. What's going on here?
That is a very funny contradiction. It's kind of slapping your hand away from the cookie jar at one moment and then releasing ravenous wild animals into the population the next. It's a very strange state of affairs. But as Mark was saying there, Chris, there has been developments on this front. We've been talking about this strange campaign in the UK to reintroduce wolves and various other apex predators. It has kind of already happened in parts of the continent, but it seems like partly because of the fate that befell poor Ursula von der Leyen's pony, they're starting to reassess whether the EU Commission Habitats Directive, I believe, should be revised so that it would be easier to get rid of these animals now that they're seemingly posing a threat, not just to livestock, but to humans, we should say. Do you want to tell us a bit more about the latest with this and what you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I could be wrong. I think the EU only made wolves a protected species last year. And now let's face it, is because the European Commission president and a pony eaten, they're looking to start culling them. And they probably will. By the way, if anybody needs some help culling them, I would be very happily volunteer. If the government wants to give me a cool rifle or even a machine gun, send me out and hunt down wolves in the hills of Germany or anywhere else. I would gladly do that. I'm not scared of them, you know, especially if I've got, only if I've got a gun. Where was I? Yes. So, now they're talking about a cull. If you look at wolf numbers in Germany, and probably anywhere where they've got a virtually unlimited amount of food, they just go up and up and up and up, and they will do. And they're not eating deer, as Monbiot hopes they will. If you recall from our last episode with Simon Evans, we were talking about how apparently there's too many deer knocking around in the countryside, and wolves will take care of them. Well, they haven't been hunting deer so much as sheep and ponies, which are easier to catch. And if they've got in effect unlimited amount of food, then their numbers obviously are going to keep increasing, and eventually you need a predator to go after the wolves, which, as I say, I'm happy to volunteer for.
So unless there's any more on wolves, shall we move to our postbag question sent in by our listeners?
Postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
Mark, if we haven't told you about this is where people who listen to the show can pose questions to yourselves. We've got one here from Matt Brugazzi. Sorry if I'm not pronouncing that correctly. Could Chris please say a few words about BrewDog? I saw him debating with someone on Twitter about how the craft beer fad is over, and I enjoy his BrewDog takedown. So Chris, could you rehearse one of those takedowns for us here right now?
What was I talking about? I think it was some story in The Guardian saying that a lot of the so-called craft breweries are struggling. And I think there was an implication that this was Brexit, and I don't think it is Brexit. I think they're struggling to sell beer to the people in this country as well, because I think it's a fad that's overdone. I know a lot of people listening to this will disagree. And look, it's only an opinion. It makes the world go around. I'm not saying it should be banned or anything. I personally think it's horrible stuff. Sort of grubby little metallic-tasting Alco Pops for millennials, really. Massively overpriced. And people have finally seen through it, and therefore they're not buying this disgusting American-influenced rubbish anymore. And I hope they will continue to avoid it. I don't like BrewDog in particular because BrewDog supported minimum pricing. I think they got Me Too'd as well, didn't they? Some people at BrewDog.
There's definitely been some scandals.
You know, a toxic work.
Even if it's not, even if it's not kind of sexual stuff, it's something's gone on there. I seem to remember
toxic culture. Yeah,
because they do present themselves as very kind of worthy. I think they even made a Barnard's Castle beer during lockdown.
Oh, did they? Oh, how very funny.
Yeah, which is, and they gave it to Keir Starmer. It was
That's what lions. Yeah. Was it lions led by donkeys drink?
Exactly. They look, they're the exact same people.
It is, isn't it? So, I mean, so I dislike them on various levels, as you can see. Look, if you want to drink it, fine, drink it. I introduced it to my snooker club because I knew people, you know, wanted it. It's fine. But personally, I think it is the work of the devil and people should drink Birra Moretti.
And Mark, unless you've got very strong feelings about BrewDog, there's another question here, which... is more on the sort of question of culture and values, the sort of things that you talk and write about a lot, but with a bit of a geopolitical spin. So this question here from Twitter saying, is Putin right that Western society is terminally decadent? And of course, people might have noticed that in recent years, Vladimir Putin has taken to trying to latch on, I think, to the kind of Anglo-American culture war to suggest that we've all completely lost our minds, to very opportunistically kind of position himself, I would say, as the sort of font of common sense and tradition, and has actually been won over by some of America's more credulous conservatives, I think, in this particular endeavor. But Mark, what do you make of that, how the culture war's kind of gone global in that sense?
Well, of course, there's a huge irony in somebody like Putin trashing aspects of Western culture or sort of emerging, you know, ideological forms, when of course he's another authoritarian. So what he's essentially lambasting, rightly, is the way in which, you know, reason, logic, are being delegitimized in the West. But of course, he's from, you know, another type of politically authoritarian tradition, which equally doesn't believe in the right of, you know, the Russian people to challenge him and contest ideas openly. So he's another sort of strain of authoritarian anti-liberalism. And so that's obviously a strain that is well established and more traditional within the, you know, the Russian East European sphere. What we are experiencing is the emergence of a new sort of counter-enlightenment within our world, which was until, you know, let us say 25, 30 years ago, predicated on broadly politically, if not economically, liberal values. And that is what is now under threat within our society. So, in fact, I, as a liberal, I see Mr. Putin having quite a lot in common with the, you know, the people who want to ban trans conversion therapy, as they would call it. I mean, they're all different manifestations of authoritarianism, which want to guide society towards predetermined outcomes that they happen to like subjectively. And, you know, the rest of us can go hang, whether we're in Russia or in Britain or America or wherever we happen to be.
Do you remember when Putin started going on about J.K. Rowling? Do you remember that press conference? That was very funny, wasn't it? Who do you think, Mark, he's trying to appeal to with this kind of stuff? Is he just trying to appeal to people in his own country? Or is he trying to appeal to, you know, middle-aged men in America who think that Putin's quite based?
I mean, it's a very interesting question as to, you know, why he got involved in that issue. I mean, I suspect that within the Russian world, as within, you know, other places as well, that in addition to the liberal reservations about transgender ideology, there is obviously also a small c conservative objection to it. And so actually his intervention is incredibly unhelpful from our perspective, because he's not opposing trans ideology from a, you know, liberal point of view. He's
just opposing trans people, basically.
He just doesn't want to, for his own reasons, to see people claiming they are of a different sex to the one they were born with.
Definitely. That was a real curveball question, Mark. So I appreciate you dealing with it so well. Another final curveball for you is, at the end of this show, we ask our guests, given that this is a very liberal to libertarian kind of show, we're against banning things generally on principle.
They're getting less and less like that, isn't it, to be honest? You know, having a go at BrewDog, like banning wolves.
It's become more, exactly, we're shooting wolves and we're clamping down on those bully XLs, all sorts. But if you could have one ban, Mark, what would it be? And it's got to be something that's really petty. It can't be something worthy. It can't be banning hunger or sadness. What would you ban?
I have one, very easy to come up with. I would ban the wearing of what I call, probably in a very dated way, knapsacks. What are they called now?
Backpacks? Rucksacks?
Yes, backpacks, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're younger and more trendy, obviously, Chris.
They've been called that for quite a while.
But I mean, just, you get on the tube and there are people with enormous, things on their back. And you're thinking, what are you going hiking in, the mountains or something? And they're getting off at Canada Water. They're working in the city or something. They're suited and they've got these enormous things on their back, bump into you. And sort of grumpy gamins like me get very angry about that. And also then I hate the other end of the continuum on that. So you don't then see... particularly young women, not so much young men, wearing tiny ones that are the size of a sort of postage stamp, obviously for some sort of fashionista reason.
Well, that's all right. What's the problem with that? I can understand why you hate backpacks. They are annoying. And people who wear them, particularly on the tube, they don't seem to realize how much room they're taking up and move their body accordingly. But if you've got a tiny little one on your back, that's surely a victimless crime, isn't it?
No, but I'm against it aesthetically. There's something annoying.
Okay, good. Well, that's the kind of petty thing we're at. Just people carrying, like, I mean, mine is having the wheelie suitcases. So we're just against anyone carrying luggage in London, aren't we?
Absolutely. Yeah.
It is strike the wheelie suitcases. Ever since you've mentioned it, I see it everywhere. And you think these people are not going away. Like on holiday or something, it just seems to be a part of life.
I don't know. You can have a good time if you're ever, at Victoria Station waiting for a train. Just get near the ticket barriers and just sit there watching how many people with these big wheelie suitcases get them caught behind them. They put the ticket in, they get halfway through, the thing closes, and they're just stuck there waiting for someone to bail them out. And people, if you're behind someone like that, do not bail them out. Just leave them there.
I think we've got a wheelie crisis in this society now, to add to all our other crises. I think something needs to be done. You're right.
And only on this podcast are we taking it seriously. Brilliant. Mark, Chris, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.